Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and you are listening to Recovery Radio on KRFP 90.3 FM, Moscow Pullman. Recovery Radio is recorded live at the Latah Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addictions and behavioral health disorders affect us all and how we deal with them. We also share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continued recovery. And for the calendar, I'm going to direct you all to the latahrecoverycenter.org website, and you can see all the offerings there are there. I can say there are AA meetings here just about every day of the week at noon, and NA meetings at 7 o'clock. And there's just a whole ton of other really cool things on the calendar there, so go check it out. And today in the studio slash conference room with me is Edward, or Ed, whatever you like to go by.
Ed works.
Okay, Ed. And Ed, was, you know, maybe give us a little background info, how you wound up in the Moscow, Pullman, Lewiston, Clarkston, Quad Cities area, and then maybe we'll go into your sharing your experience, strength, and hope.
Well, sure. Thanks for having me here. I'm 47 years old, and I was born in Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, actually. And 14 years after that was my initial introduction to the Quad Cities area, to Lewis and Clarkston. So as a freshman in high school, I left L.A., and I was put in a different place. So it was kind of like, for me, I felt leaving. It was like leaving Baywatch and moving to Mayberry.
Yeah. You know?
Los Angeles is so expansive and huge. I had a, you know, like a great uncle of mine that was on TV and on the movies. I made a commercial as a kid, but like, you know, the idea you get up to the top of that Lewiston Hill and like you can see the edge. It's like, oh, you know, it's small. So pretty quickly I got in trouble. It was easier to stick out in a smaller town. I think I got arrested 2 weeks into there. And a lot of time in my experience, you hear people say, I was never arrested sober. But this time I was. When I was 14 years old, there was girls involved, though. I got excited. And what I did was I did some joyriding. My parents had gone out of town, so I took their car out. I knew that people did the loop. I had two girls in the car with me. And the police pulled over the 14-year-old, you know. And that was my first trip to jail. And I ended up getting grounded for like a year. And I ended up, you know, because now I couldn't go out. I'd been arrested. I got branded pretty quick. You know, I made some friends, and some really good friends that I still have today there. But my drinking got out of control really fast.
Do you remember your first drink?
As a kid, I mean, I remember running around weddings and sipping people's champagne.
Sure.
And stuff and getting headaches, getting kind of sick over it. But so my first, we can go back, the introduction is eighth grade. I'm still in Los Angeles, and I got some friends from East Los Angeles, some Mexican guys, and they're older. So I'm going with a family, and we're going to go to Big Bear, going to go skiing for the first time. And I go out with those guys, and they hand me a beer. And they kept on handing me beer, and I drank a lot more beer than they thought I would. And actually, they insisted that I smoke weed because I'd gotten so hopped up on beer, there was no way that they were going to calm me down. And then that to me was like, oh my God, that's drugs. Like, I can drink alcohol, but drug, no way. And I was, you know, blitzed off of alcohol. Like, I think it was the first time I started losing my clothes with alcohol there, you know, at 14 years old. And I woke up the next day really completely hungover, just sick, puking. I felt awful. But I knew I was going to do it again. I knew that I was going to do it again. I knew that the way that I'd felt, you know, I'd felt comfortable from those guys that were, you know, from the hood, you know, and I could talk to them as, instead of being like cowered in the corner and stuff like that. I was able to be brave, and I just, you know, that feeling that's, that I've heard described in the rooms also is like, you know, I felt like I'd arrived. I felt like, oh, this is why people have been hiding it from me. I'll go back a little bit too. Both my father, my parents divorced when I was very early. My father, who just passed away at 49 years sober. So I didn't see him drink. And my uncle in the house that I grew up in, he didn't drink either. So it just wasn't really around. My mother maybe would have a screwdriver every 6 months and then get flushed and be like, oh, that's too much. You know, that's right. How my mother does.
Right, those weirdos. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But she's good at finding alcoholics to marry, I'll tell you that. So so it's always around. So then we fast forward to a couple years. I'm in Clarkston, and I get my first job at the Little Caesars. And I learn how to do pizza. I do some deliveries and things like that. And I've got a manager. Gambling's part of my story, too. I have a guy, and he's a really huge Dallas Cowboys football fan. And he was a manager. And he bet his whole paycheck against my whole paycheck. You know, and that was a 16-year-old that's maybe working 14 hours. And
yeah,
his manager paycheck, that the Dallas Cowboys were going to win the Super Bowl. And by the time, and I had the whole field. So I took that bet really easy. So instead of him paying me his whole paycheck, which he couldn't afford to do, he went to the liquor store for me like 5 weekends in a row with $50.
Uh-huh.
So I'm a 17-year-old kid that's got like a gift card to the liquor store for $50 for 6 weeks.
Wow.
So by the time that 6 weeks is over, there's been at least 3 times that I've drank a fifth. I'm always trying to do something different because, like I said, in my house, alcohol wasn't really around. So I wasn't able to go down in the bars and take little sips and things like that. You know, I can only do that at parties. But I got a taste for it. And that's, you know, my friends that are, you know, still friends with me now. Like, that was the first time my friends were like, wow, you know, you're like this afternoon, after school special sort of thing, man. Like, you are going. And, like, it's not looking good for you. And my idea was just, you know, I'd arrive. Like, this is how life could feel. I had confidence. I could talk to girls. I wanted to race around. So that was my introduction to here. And then out of Clarkston High School, when I graduated in 1996, I joined the Navy. And part of that decision, too, was I felt that the Navy had a drinking culture. And it was going to be a place that I, because I'd already gotten in trouble. I'd gotten sent to AA at 17 years old. I go off to the Navy, and I get in trouble, too. Oh, what I was saying is, in high school, one of those times after I was done working and I had a fifth in the car, I went to the high school football game, just blitzed. I was being not the greatest senior to some freshmen, and my principal, he's like, you got to get out of here. I said, okay, look, I'll get out of here if you promise. I'm not going to get in trouble for this. I won't cause a scene or anything. He's like, yeah, that's fine, but come see me on Monday. You won't get in trouble. So he had me go to AA a couple times. That club that's still there down on Elm and 15th. Anyway, I joined the Navy, and really quick, like this is a really sad, like, I joined the Navy to be a corpsman. I wanted to be a pharmacist. I worked at Wassums. I wanted to be a pharmacist mate, and I was going to learn, and they were going to send me to tech school. And instead, they, you know, explained to me that corpsmen were also the only Navy people that went and served with the Marines, and I ended up spending a lot of time with the Marines. But even at that attachment, they found the opportunity, knowing that that's what I wanted to do, and they got me a TAD assignment to Okinawa Naval Hospital, Camp Lester. With that opportunity, at 20 years old, I walked into that pharmacy wasted from the night before. You know, I was 20 years old. These guys were leaving the island the night before. I stayed up all night partying with them, all night, you know, and then maybe slept for an hour and shaved. And I blew any opportunity that I had there. You know, people had made, you know, what happened to me is I got sent back to my senior chief, who'd give me the opportunity, Senior Chief Martinez. And I went and washed dishes in the galley for a couple weeks, because corpsmen don't generally have to go wash dishes in the galley with the Marines. But if that's what I was doing with my corpsman opportunities, they figured I could go wash some dishes for a little bit. That was my real true introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I had to start to go to meetings on base. you know, I'm an old guy now. I'm 47, but you can imagine like being a 20-year-old and a 25-year-old's an old guy, you know, and they're the ones running the meeting, like this sergeant, you know, a 23-year-old sergeant or something, like, you know, a staff sergeant's going to be 28, 29 years old, you know, and
right.
have 6 years or something like that, you know, and it's, and I'd get some sobriety, but what would happen is, of course, I would 60, 90 days. And what happened at that point was I had left Okinawa and I got to come back to the United States. And in my thinking, how could I really call myself an alcoholic if I hadn't even had my first legal drink yet? That was my thinking. It was the legal drink. Now, like I said, my father died with 49 years sobriety. So I kind of always grew up knowing about it, at least being warned about it. I have a grandmother that I never met who took her life with booze and pills, and she's got a first edition of our AA book. And then I have this other thing, too, that I was a compulsive gambler. And one time the Navy told me, I went to a shrink, and the shrink was like, your drinking problem is nothing compared to your gambling problem. And I was like, well, I'm living in Southern California, and I'm not driving to Vegas every day, but I'm getting drunk every day. You know,
right?
Would you, you know, what would you be? I go, I don't know. I, you know, so I ended up going to rehab a couple times in the Navy. I ended up being able to get my honorable discharge from the Navy. I didn't get in enough trouble to have to get kicked out or anything like that. But at one point, I did have to go and check in with my senior chief every morning at 8 a.m. and take an anabuse pill for about 9 months. So that's probably not normal drinking. You know?
Probably not. Yeah. That's probably not a requirement they would put on an average temperate drinker. Yeah.
So I got out like 67 days after September 11th. So I was sitting in Southern California and I saw, you know, the planes crash into the towers and I was in the military and like, maybe I got to stay or maybe, but I'd hurt my knee and I got out. My 1 year anniversary of getting out of the Navy, I was sitting in front of a judge for my third DUI. I'd gotten three DUIs in a year.
Oh.
Luckily for me, one of them happened in Nevada. One, two of them happened in California. So there was another state involved. Or if those three would have happened in California, I would have had a felony and I would have gone for a minimum of 18 months to prison.
Sure.
With the second one in California and it really being my third, I got the maximum misdemeanor sentence. I got sentenced to 120 days and I served 80 days in Orange County. That was when I was 25. You know, lost my girlfriend, lost all the things that I'd, you know, tried to build in the first half of my 20s. So I get out of jail and I don't want to quit drinking. And I'm mad at everybody. And now because I had to go to jail, I feel like I deserve to get to drink now a little bit. And I just got to figure out how to not drink and drive. And for 10 years, I don't. And for 10 years, I don't. No, I drink and drive a lot. I continue to do all this, and luckily I just don't get caught. But I continue to do all the bad stuff. I just somehow or other do not get caught. And these things in my life, like I said, now I've been introduced to AA. It was in my family. I got sent to it as a teenager. I'd have these ideas of like, you know, well, maybe when I got my career together, that'll be when I get sober. Maybe when I buy a house, that's going to be when I get sober. Maybe when my relationship gets together, when I graduate college, that'll be when I get sober. And none of these things were happening, you know, and I was just kept on lowering my goals, you know. But there was always, I just thought I was going to get sober. Maybe I felt that I had to get sober at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we all have that sneaking suspicion that something needs to change. It's just a matter of, when the time's right, I'll do it.
Yeah. So there was about 8 years in between maybe my 1,000th Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, the last one that didn't work, to the first one that actually did. I was in the San Fernando Valley. I walked into Radford Hall at 8 a.m., blitzed out of my mind, yelling about, what the hell does honesty do anything for my program? Like, how can I be honest? If I'm honest, I'm going to go back to jail. If I'm honest, I'm going to get kicked out of my house. If I'm honest, I'm going to lose everything. And they're like, keep coming back. You're in the right place.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you stupid old man. Yeah. So I was mad at that point. I left. And I left LA. I became a sales guy that would drive around all over the country and be like, okay, I'm going to sell in Colorado this week, and I'd go to Denver. I'm going to sell in Texas, or I'm going to go to Miami. It's like that. I finally ended up in Portland, Oregon, and I had to deal with a gambling problem because I owed a bunch of money, and I had a client that was paying me some money that they owed me. So they paid me. I went to Miami, and I got paid a $5,000 commission. In between Miami and Portland, they gave me a layover in Las Vegas. And basically in that layover all night long, $100 bill at a time, I walked it over across the street to the slot machine and got it down to like $1,500. Then I went to the airport for the airplane and came home with like $57 when I started with $5,000. And that was the money I needed to pay all my rent and all my backup. That was November 30th, 2012. So that's when recovery started for me. That's when I became a real hardcore member of Gamblers Anonymous. And that's where I met people that would change my life. But I didn't want to quit drinking because alcohol was still working. I was still getting that solution. It was still taking me to oblivion. It was still getting me out of my head. And I figured if I could just tackle the money problem, everything, you know, money was going to fix everything. And in truth, when you have a gambling problem like I did, things get better pretty quickly because you're just not bleeding out money anymore.
Right.
It's pretty fast. But I kept on drinking. And I took my coin. I remember I took a six-month coin. And I was working with the guy, my sponsor in that program. He was an alcoholic. And he's like, you realize that half the people at our GA meetings are drunks too. I'm like, yeah. So like, we all got problems. He's like,
thanks for the news flash, but yeah,
but I'm he's like, you realize that you sit in the middle of their recovery circles hammered and talk. And I'm like, well, this is for gambling. He's like, okay, you might have an alcohol problem. And I was like, I don't think so. I'm like, I used to get DUIs, but I don't get in trouble for it anymore. He's like, you're sitting in recovery meetings hammered. And I was just like, I'm recovering from gambling. And it just, I could not get it. And then about 4 months later, what he had warned me in some later time, because I would call him from this place called Claudia's that I would drink at because there's a poker room on the other side of it. And he said, you know, once again, do you realize when it is that you're calling me? Yeah, I'm calling you because I'm triggered to gamble and you're who I call. You're my sponsor. He's like, no, but do you realize that you're getting triggered to gamble whenever you're drinking? It's you're drinking and then you're calling me and you're triggered. And, you know, what's going to happen if you're anything like me, and that's what I hear, you know, people in AA said. He's like, if you're anything like me, you're going to walk into one of these bars with a head full of whiskey and you're going to see that video slot machine and think it's your time and lose your time and lose everything you've been doing here.
Right.
And I'm like, I don't think so. And a week later, I did it. A week later, I went into a bar. You know, there'd been something that hadn't gone my way. And I looked at that machine. I was like, all right, it's been 6 months. I'm due.
Mm-hmm.
And I woke up with a hangover and a wallet full of receipts and no cash. And now I had a real problem on my hands because I was doing Gamblers Anonymous and everything I'd done for 6 months, I had not gambled. But now I'd added alcohol to the mix. And now, just like I can't promise myself that I won't drink and drive, I can't promise myself that I won't gamble. And so that set off the last 6 weeks of my drinking. And so I called that guy, my sponsor in GA, and I said, I have a drinking problem. And he said, no crap, but he didn't say crap. And so I'm like, hey, will you sponsor me? Will you help me? He's like, nope, but I'll get you to some meetings. I know where you got to be tomorrow because there's a business meeting and you're going to get yourself a commitment. And that's going to be what you do. And that'll probably be, you know, a place where you can find your new sponsor. Like I've tried to work you in some ways and I just couldn't do it. I wasn't successful. Right. I'm like, come on, you got to help. He's like, well, you know what else? I resent you. I resent that you were able to drink for 6 months and not gamble. I can't do it. If I drink, I gamble and I hate it. So he's like, so I can just say that. I'm personally involved in your resentment. I'm like, okay, fine.
Yeah.
He had spent that last Christmas with me drinking. He spent my first Christmas with me sober. We did a lot together. I ended up getting a job really fast. Like, I was pretty hardcore unemployable. Like, my last few months in Portland, a couple times a week, I would drive to the plasma center so I could sell my plasma for $50. Sometimes I was so dehydrated that they couldn't accept my plasma, and I'd spent my last, you know, 50 cents on gas to get there, expecting the cash on the way out. Just a lot of just living like that, you know, taking tip money that my waitress roommate would make so that I could go buy myself a 24-ounce of Steel Reserve. Just not really living up. But, you know, if you would have come up and asked me what was going on in my life at that time, I could have told you, like, there was, like, if my dad would do this and this guy would just do this and if this old boss would just pay, I'd be fine. Like, I just got three little moves that I got to do and everything's going to be fine. And in the same way, too, and if you said, look, you're going to be really happy for the next 11 years in your life, but you're going to spend 95% of your Friday nights in an AA meeting, I'd be like, no way. Like,
that's not happening.
That's not. Because going back to the, you know, that shrink that was telling me, you know, recovery, working with me and gambling and stuff, you know, he's like, you know, you probably need to get involved in one of these programs and just be the guy that makes coffee. And, yeah, you know, I was like 22 at the time. I'm like, you know, that sounds so lame. I go, really?
Right.
I want to be the guy that's excited and grateful because I'm here at 8 a.m. to make coffee. I'm like, I'd rather be dead. And that's really how I felt. And that's really how, I mean, that's really how things have changed. You know, I'm grateful that for the last 11 years. So you've heard about my mess. I get sober. Unfortunately, Tim, who was the guy in the gambling, the sober guy, he drinks at about when I'm about 2.5 years sober, and he hasn't made it back into the rooms, even though he did all this work for me and helped me, and I wouldn't be here, and I'm now sober longer than he's ever been sober. I would not be here without him.
Right.
There's absolutely no, you know, so it's a day at a time, and sometimes it's a really special day, and you got to grab that really special day and do some special things with it, and it'll last for you, but you can lose it all in a day, too.
That's right.
So I'd moved to Portland. I'd spent my last year and a half there drinking, and then I lived there for another 6 years sober. And I got to see Oregon through Alcoholics Anonymous because I became a GSR. I would get to go to all these conferences, you know.
And just for people that don't know, GSR is a General Service Representative.
Absolutely.
It's one of the service positions in most AA groups. They have, like, treasurers, secretaries, general service representatives, et cetera. So just so people understand, sure. The TLAs, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's I would say it's a connection for the groups to AA as a whole and back and forth. You know, we serve with some communications. That's a good thing I can talk about, too.
Yeah.
So being that we do that, we would meet. So the reason I would get to see Oregon is that we would have an assembly in Medford, and then 3 months later there'd be an assembly in Burns, and then 3 months later there'd be an assembly in Albany. And instead of when I used to take a trip or go anywhere, I'd hit two bars, and that would be the only thing I'd see of a city. That'd be the only thing I know. And now I've got all these great experiences, memories that I get to keep forever in Portland, in Oregon. So one of those things about being a GSR, I was a general service rep for a group on MLK Boulevard in Portland at a club called, it's now called True Colors, but it used to be called the Fourth Dimension. You know, recently in the last few years, Alcoholics Anonymous has changed the preamble to have it be more inclusive. You know, we took a vote, and instead of it saying a fellowship of men and women, now it says a fellowship of people. And my group and my people in that, my group were talking about that back in like 2015. And in this experience, I can tell you about like how I changed my mind. Because I was one of the people. It's like, well, you can do what you want, but as soon as you change a word, you can't call it AA anymore. You know, you're changing my stuff. And when we changed it to men and women, from men and women to people back then, we got more people coming. We had more people showing up. And when we didn't say a male or female sponsorship coordinator, we just said, go to the sponsorship coordinator you feel you want to go to. We didn't, it worked out just fine. And that's one of those things because, in my opinion, I was the GSR. So as the group service rep, I didn't really get to have an opinion.
No, because your job is just to bring the message back and forth. A lot of people don't understand, I'll kind of interject here, that AA is a bottom-up organization. The General Service Office in New York does not send out edicts that the rest of the groups and clubs and meetings have to follow. The meetings and groups, through their GSRs and their area assembly reps and their district reps and all this, send desires for changes up the chain. And it gets voted through from the bottom up. And if for some reason it collapses in that process, it's up to the groups to start running it, literally running it up the flagpole again. And when there's consensus, you know, a majority of votes, then the GSR will, you know, make a change to the book, for instance, or literature, yeah, or something like that, or the preamble where it says people. And when that finally trickled into Moscow in regards to that, the people, I looked at it and I thought, oh, this sounds like a political thing. I struggled with that for a minute because it seemed like an outside problem. And I realized that people is a perfect word to describe men and women as well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how anyone else might want to interpret that, if they're gender fluid, fine. It's great. And like you said, in your case, it brought more people in, and I can understand that in the, you know, in a Portland setting, mm-hmm. where it's a very progressive area. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure how it was going to work in a more conservative area like Moscow, Pullman, you know, even though we're kind of a really weird mix of progressives and rednecks. Mm-hmm. But proof we can get along.
Absolutely, yeah. We got a rainbow flag right outside here of the recovery center.
Yeah. So what I noticed was it didn't necessarily increase the membership here. It didn't decrease it either. You know, so it showed me that, you know, people, regardless of their political bias one way or another, remember that the whole thing is we're here to help alcoholics get sober and stay sober.
Right.
So why are you going to let, I mean, I know people that dropped out of meetings because of the word people was in there.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other meetings where they don't use a preamble. They use other information from the books, and that worked for them. So.
Sure, kind of
all,
like
all the, I was saying, we're very flexible.
The Sunday meeting that you and I, that I met you at, is a meeting that does not have a prayer.
Right.
You know, and that's something that I like.
Right.
You know, and it's just, you know, you find what works for you in your mix. But I think you explained that upside down triangle really, really well. And for me, you know, this is me putting my GSR hat on.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's important to be plugged in, because the reason I found out about, like, the change being happening is I went to a delegate's report. And we get to, you know, hear from the delegate about how these changes and how these happen. And like I said, but at that delegate report, it was 2023. It's like, oh, yeah, this is stuff that my group was talking about at their assemblies, you know, 7 years ago. And it worked its way up, you know. So that's been kind of... You know, like it's, like you say, there it's an interesting cleavage, and I guess it's not just even in the recovery community. I just think that there's a lot of city versus, you know, rural versus urban, and that just runs in our country no matter what, city mouse, country mouse. But I mean, it's really exasperated right now.
Yeah. Well, and AA is pretty pretty straightforward when they, you know, in the traditions. It says the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking.
Yeah.
It doesn't say you can only be white or black, or you can only be a Republican or a Democrat or an independent.
The realm of the spirit is broad and inclusive, never exclusive.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So that's good news. So you got into service, and
I get into
service.
I think
you're still in Portland.
Still in Portland, but things changed about 5 years sober because I Tim does a good job. I got a sponsor named Jason and then Eric. And 2 years sober, I bought a house and I got two cars in the driveway. I did the stuff, and that's incredible because at 33, I wasn't ever going to do. I couldn't pay the rent, you know, on the couch that somebody was letting me live on in their family room, you know. And I'd bought a house. Lived in the house for 4 years. I changed jobs. I got a different job, a job that really fancy sales job. I had to be in Portland downtown at 6 a.m. I got to go on trade missions. I flew to Central America. I flew to Panama, Mexico, the Dominican Republic. Really fun stuff. And then that job ended. And the economy looked a lot different. And one of the things about my first sponsor, Jason, that he did really early on with me was he took me to a meditation meeting. Mm. And what was cool about this guy was, and I'm a person that believes in God, no problem. He was a happy, really devout, not scared to tell you that he was an atheist. And he was not scared to tell you that having worked the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, he believed his stuff stronger than he did before, but it didn't take away anything that AA said, you know, that power greater than himself, you know, you don't have to believe in what you believe in, but the power of AA was something he couldn't deny.
Right.
And I was like, oh, great. Like, that's the guy that I will choose. Because I was scared that somebody was going to, you know, on a third step was going to take me to some church and say that I was going to have to get on my knees and turn my life over to Christ and something like that. And
right.
I, you know, I didn't want that, you know, to be. So when I found that guy, you know, and the godless quarter of Portland, I was very glad to get him. And through that work, what I had to do at like 3 years sober, because that job goes away, I get into adult children of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because
mm-hmm.
now it's, you know, I'm 3 years sober. I'm not burning my life down anymore. I'm got my bills paid, you know, like my credit score's probably jumped up 200 points. I bought a house. I can't turn the bad thoughts off in my head. I can't get my stories to say, might as well drink. How long do you think this is going to last? Who do you think you are? Blow it up. Mm-hmm. That would be the message over and over again. And I started going to adult children of Alcoholics Anonymous. And going there became really, really just obvious that when I took that first drink, you know, let's say with the 14-year-olds, at the 14-year-old ed, I was drinking to relieve me of things that were already there. You know,
right.
They were things that were in me before that alcohol even touched me. It just activated it.
Sure.
And it's the same way that now I haven't had a drink at that point for 3 years, today 11 years. My thoughts are still with me, you know, and you know, we read that Alcoholics Anonymous big book, and that big book talks about things that I did as an adult, things that I did drinking. The adult children of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me about things that I thought when I was three. And it's like, wow.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like, because I think I was born alcoholic. I think it's something that was genetically given to me.
I'm with you there. Yeah, I believe that too.
You know, and I think that that's what the ancient Greeks used to call, you know, intergenerational curses. That's part of it. You know, the idea that alcohol is spirits, you know, that just brings the bad spirits. But, you know, I'm grateful. My dad passed away with 49 years sober. And all the things in my life that could have gone better or worse or whatever, my dad not having a drink is the greatest gift he gave me,
mm-hmm.
by far. You know, and I knew that AA would be there for to work, you know, if
did
I was
you,
able to get
did
on.
Did you have that in the back of your mind? Because my mother got into AA and was sober the last 10 years of her life. And I'm convinced that the reason I went to AA when I stopped drinking, and even when I asked God for help in the middle of the night one night to solve this drinking problem, AA was on my mind. Mm-hmm. Even though I didn't really know anything about it other than it had kept my mom sober for 10 years, and she was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So did you kind of have that in the back of your head as well?
Yeah, I did. And I mean, I think it's a really bad idea for us to have in the back of our heads because of, you know, it is a miracle that it did happen. And I remember at one point I reached out to my dad and I was like, look, you know, I'd like to get our relationship going again. And what I'll do is I'll just go to AA and I'll email you when I got 60 days. And he's like, as if it's that easy. you're gonna email me in 60 days because you went to AA today and be sober. Yeah, you don't know jack about Jack is basically what he said.
Right.
And you know, sometimes I think I did keep it in my back pocket long enough. You know, the fear was when I showed up, I knew, you know, I'd been to 1,000 meetings, I'd been sentenced to them. Was I the person that was constitutionally incapable of being honest?
Mm.
I was really freaked out about that. But no, I knew that AA could work. And like I said, it was that part as a young person, like, I need to get there at some point. I need to get there at some point. So I lose that fancy job where I'm flying around everywhere. But the thing that really Jason had done really well for me early on, he took me to some meditation meetings. And he's like, you can start doing 10 and 11 and 12 right now. Just start minding your behavior nowadays. Start doing the prayer and meditation. And just helping others, and honestly, just being at Alcoholics Anonymous program, you know, just being at meetings, you're helping somebody. You're filling a seat. Somebody's not feeling alone. They're a little less lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And that meditation practice became very, very good. I was talking about it yesterday. Today, I did not meditate. I'm a meditation teacher nowadays. I'm a mindfulness mentor nowadays. But there's days that I don't sit down and do my 5 minutes in the morning like I'm supposed to, even though I know if I do those 5 minutes, everything else is going to fit in fine. But I can't get over that story saying, like, get out the door right now, you're late.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though I know from experience that it's going to work out well for me. So anyway, I lose that job. I'm trying to hold on to that house. But I'm 40 years old, and I get really involved with my young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. People have been trying to drag me into this YPAW stuff. You know, and I just was like, look, I went to AA in my 20s. I could have had fun as a young kid, and I screwed up. You know, I have to go hang out with the old. They're like, the meetings that you're dealing with, like, you know, that meeting salty bunch that you know, was interested in changing the world, that was a young people's meeting. But I didn't see it that way. I was just like, it's my meeting that I go to at 8. I liked it because it was big. Mm-hmm. I liked it because it was outside of my neighborhood. It meant that I had to go somewhere and I'd meet people. And they were... There's at that point there were 700 meetings in Portland a week, so there was a group of us. There's probably like 30 of us that would see each other six times a week in six different places.
Yeah.
Plus, I had my 10 p.m. meeting every night that I go to. So for the first time, instead of, because I'd be showing up to my meetings and I'd always be buttoned down and having worked late and shiny shoes and running their business, being like, why can't you have some fun? So, like, I ended up camping with them, and I ended up going and floating in the river and doing a lot of young people's and going to my first convention at 40 and going, like, that was dumb, you know, because for 5 years, I kept myself away from there. For 5 years, and people sometimes, you know, they hear about young people, like, oh, that's being exclusive. It's like, you're the one that's excluding yourself, you know. Young people in Alcoholics Anonymous want to hear about other people and how we got there. It's one of the coolest things. And it is really an incredible experience to be at one of these big conferences and you have a countdown with like 5,000 people and you're with them all weekend long and they're just having so much fun. That idea, like I said, I couldn't imagine a life without alcohol.
Right.
And I'm having all this incredible fun now without it. You know, the meditation, it led to yoga. Eventually, my mom got sick in L.A. and I had to sell my house and I went to L.A. And that was right about the time the pandemic hit. And it was really nice to be down there because my dad had taken me to meetings as a kid. I'd left LA at 30 and now I was back at 41. And I was living in a different area. I was basically, you know, living the life of my dreams. And it was a life that I was scared of trying to do with like a 2 year sober. I'd talk to my friend Cedar and I'd be like, hey, Cedar, you know, I really think I want to go to LA. I really think I want, I'm selling this insurance and doing really good. In the market, I'd make 10 times as much, but I'd burn through my money 10 times as fast, so I'm kind of scared. And then everything went away. But 8 years later, I had that job that I was scared to take anyway, after everything went away anyway, and I got to sit there and do it. And then from the first question you asked me, what ended up bringing me back is that my father in summer of 2022 went into the hospital with COVID. He's had emphysema his whole life. Most of his life, he burnt his lungs early. So I came up here at the end of 2022 and I've been caregiving for him, who just passed away in February, and my stepmom. And so It was a big difference. Like I said, L.A. was a new experience for me because it was my first time that I was sober in L.A. You know, I wasn't running out of gas. I wasn't, you know, blowing deals because I was getting drunk and talking crap to people. I was doing really, really well. And, you know, and the same thing on the other side here, like it hasn't been work. It hasn't been financial. I told you, even without drinking, when I got to Lewiston, I was arrested within 2 weeks. Like that, I get in trouble there really easy, really quick. The fact that I was, you know, right now I work as a volunteer with the Nez Perce County Veterans Treatment Court.
Okay. You
know? And so I mentor a guy there and sometimes we get more. And that's a really cool thing to do. You know, it was a friend named Greg said, hey, we do this. Oh, you're a vet. You know, this would be a great thing to get you connected to. If I didn't have AA in my life, I'd be the other side of that treatment court. I'd be the guy that got in trouble because there's a lot of bad right and left turns to make in Clarkston and Lewiston. There really, really are, you know, and I'd, you know, go to some bar and have a couple of drinks and get a smart mouth or just, I am thankful that for the last, you know, and going back, like you were talking about your family, my dad, After his mom passed away, he drank for another 11 years. And then he got to see me sober for his last 11 years. So it's kind of funny.
That's kind of cool.
Kind of some funny math stuff there, yeah. So like in he was born in 1944 and I was born in 1978. And for some reason that meant when I turned 44, he turned 78.
Wow.
So there's just like these weird little things like that that have happened recently. But it was the pleasure of my life to you know, in the last few years, I was the one that was giving him his coins. He probably didn't get coins from 15 to 35 or something like that.
Right.
So it was something politics and him and I stray on. Neither of us are very, very big sports fans. I like to play music. He likes to tinker in the shop. But we had you know, we were total opposites about just about anything, but he respected my program, which I'm grateful for, you know, because like I said, that was part of it too, coming in at 35, like this is my dad's thing. And it's really not, I had to make it my own thing. For him, it's a lot different. For him, it was, you stay sober on the first step. You can just get that, you know, you get that good brainwashed in and you get yourself fixed and just like if something big happens, get back to AA. But, you know, he's like, you really just go to AA every day, like 3 or 4? I said, yeah. Like, I haven't drank yet, so that's why I'm going to keep on coming back. Because I believe we talk about this being a progressive disease within us. I think in the world it's also a progressive disease. I think it's a lot harder to stay sober in 2025 than it was in 1975. You know, I really think just so many, you know, it's trying to get you in so many different ways and so many different ways you're trying to get yourself.
Yeah, and talking about, you know, the difference between my program and my mom's program. My mom, we lived in the same town. She didn't drive, so my wife and I saw her a lot, daily. And she never worked the steps that I'm aware of. But the fellowship and her friends, and that became her social circle. And that not only kept her sober, but she was truly happy, joyous, and free. I mean, even when she came down with cancer, she didn't... you know, the people that came and visited her the most were the people in the AA program that she was involved with. But that was different when I got in because, you know, maybe in my mind I'm like, well, it didn't seem like a lot of work for her. But the more I learned about the program and the more I learned about myself and the way I drank and the rationale behind it and the history and the alcoholism that I was around growing up, I had to work this program way differently, almost exactly like you described. When I first stopped drinking, you know, I would get up, take a shower, have some breakfast, go to an 11 o'clock meeting, maybe hit a noon or a 12:30 one if I could find one, then back home, take care of business at home, and then a 5 o'clock meeting and an 8 o'clock meeting. And that's what I did.
Yeah.
7 days a week, I had to. I don't think I didn't trust myself to not go to meetings, but I knew for a fact that for an hour or an hour and a half or 2 hours, depending on the meeting, I would be safe. even if the meeting, I wasn't getting it or didn't like it or didn't like somebody there, I could go out in the parking lot and smoke till the meeting was over. And then I knew I could talk to somebody else after the meeting. But I knew I would be safe for an hour. And that's how I had to work it. It was very different than how my mom had done it. And there are millions of ways to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Personally, for me, I think getting a sponsor and working the 12 steps is a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to, you know, suffer less and recover more quickly. But that's just me. And you even talked about a friend who, or your sponsor, who was an atheist. I know atheists in this program. One fellow in particular announces regularly that he is a card-carrying atheist. Mm-hmm. And I've asked him for his card. He's never shown it to me. But regardless, he's got a higher power that he recognizes and works with, and he's been sober for a while now. So it's going to work differently with everyone.
And for me, like, just exactly on that point, that experience isn't necessarily different from mine, you know, because I'm a person that believes, but I don't have that white light experience that like Bill W. has or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't this big change or anything. It's just like, I have to move forward with this doubt. That's what my thing was. And, you know, when they describe it, it's like, we're doing the same thing, you know, right. and we got to be able to respect it.
That's right. And you know what else we have to respect? The clock here, and we're right up against it. Wow, we were going to take a break somewhere, but we never got to it. Wow. So, but that's okay. So, Ed, thank you so much for sharing your story and your experiences. I'm sure somebody out there is going to be able to relate.
Yeah, I thank you so much. And just like the part that you shared, you know, when this first got real for me, finally at 35, you know, it was 4 or 5 meetings a day too. You know, it was hanging out in places like this, going to find the next place. And like I said, we had places that we knew we would be every day, and then places throughout the week that were different places, but we'd go in groups, you know.
Yep, and we still have an opportunity like that here in Moscow and Pullman, so that's good.
And
not as big, but it's still there.
And with the way that everything changed, those people that I knew in Portland years ago, I now see them on Zoom everywhere, and those groups of guys that were running around everywhere, we're still sober.
Yeah. So I'm going to close it up here. Again, thank you, Ed, for coming up and sharing. And if you think you have a problem with substances or behavioral health, you do.